fresh out the box. Stop, look and watch. Ready yet? Get set. It's all that.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Barrett. We're hearing the theme song to All That, one of the iconic shows to appear on Nickelodeon during the network's golden age. Taking a behind-the-scenes look at the network with Matthew Klickstein, author of the book Slimed. You can share your favorite Nickelodeon memories, something you watched or have watched with your kids, on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Well, the story so far, an innovative idea in all kids' network to go on cable channels, maybe ahead of its time. It collapsed around 1983, was on the verge of bankruptcy, but then something changed. And Matthew, let's pick it up there. How did they turn things around and become the big deal that Nickelodeon became?
Well, again, those are two different questions, because they wouldn't really become the big deal, quote unquote, that Nickelodeon became until closer to the mid-90s. Because what's really ironic is, though this was the golden age for quality of television for Nickelodeon, and that they were certainly doing better than they were in those earliest years where they were just using the fledgling loss leader for movie channel, the shows that were being done weren't, making nearly the kind of money or bringing in any of the kind of advertising that the shows have been doing over the last few years. You know, they weren't even merchandising yet or anything. But what did happen was a group came through. It was basically a whole new administration. Cy Schneider, who was running Nickelodeon in its earliest years and helped to create the Barbie doll, actually, was sort of an advertising guy. He left, and Geraldine Laybourne came in and became president in 1983. And she and a group of folks, including Fred Seibert and Alan Goodman, who also created the iconic MTV logo and Riff and a lot of the early animation for MTV, got involved. And basically, and this is the headline that's used in a lot of the early articles, they went from worst to first in 6 months just by changing the scheduling around and doing some really innovative little promos and making Nickelodeon more of a destination place for kids and for parents to have their kids watch. I mean, in those earliest years, they were doing something called spot scheduling, where people wouldn't even know when certain shows are going to be on. You might watch something at 8 p.m. on Tuesday, and it wouldn't be the same show the next 8 p.m. on Tuesday. So just making little changes, like letting people know when the shows would actually be on, was something that Jerry, Fred, Alan, and a few other people started doing. And then, of course, they would end up purchasing shows like and working on shows like You Can't Do That on Television. And then, they went to a whole other level at that point.
You talk to a lot of the child actors. There are a lot of child actors on Nickelodeon, on the show you just mentioned, and a lot of the drama sitcom types of shows. What was life like for them?
It was very much the same as it was for a lot of other children, only instead of going to soccer practice after school or having a paper route, they would go and make their TV show. During this golden age, one of the things that made it so special was the aesthetic of something that everyone brought up as anti-Disney, meaning these were not blonde-haired, blue-eyed, cherubic, little angel children. These kids were fat. They were pimple-faced. They had greasy hair. They had braces. They were pretty much, kids just, from your next-door neighbors and that kind of thing. And because of that, you didn't really have a lot of the stage mom situation, didn't have a lot of the divas. These were just kids that they kind of found, and many of them were not actors before these shows, and many of them were not actors after these shows. So during this time, they were kind of allowed to be kids. They, would hang out, they'd do the shows, and then they'd go home. And that was pretty much how it worked for 90% of the people involved in these shows. As time went on, and we started going into, the late 80s, early 90s, and Nickelodeon started building prestige and power, you had a lot more of the actual kind of child actor experience, and they were being tutored instead of going to regular school, and they were being kind of shipped around the country to shoot and that sort of thing. But there was definitely a time where there was a lot of innocence there, and it was, a lot of the kids described it as that's what they did instead of going to soccer practice.
You interviewed a lot of them. As I mentioned, we hear horror stories of child actors gone wrong as they hit adulthood, from stories ranging from tragic to pathetic. How did these kids turn out when you talk to them as grownups?
Because of who these kids were and a lot of who their parents were, many of their parents really worked with them to understand that this was kind of a short-lived thing. and not to rely too much on it. You know, and the way that Nickelodeon chose these kids, which was, you know, looking for people with more personality, who were a little bit more precocious, and you could really see that on these shows. Many of them grew up to become, you know, doctors, lawyers, college professors. A lot of them are teachers in different ways, many, many teachers. And I think that that really says a lot about who these kids were and the kinds of people that Nickelodeon was looking to work with as far as children's concerned. Now, obviously, you know, I'm not talking here about a little later on, we have people like Amanda Bynes and that kind of thing. But, you know, that was around when Nickelodeon started changing from, you know, this golden age from what, you know, we believe and the people who work on the book with me believe to, you know, more of just this kind of mass merchandising machine, which is, you know, in its own way, a different kind of golden age. It certainly made a lot more money and became globalized. And, you know, they shifted the priorities in a way that was, you know, beneficial in some regards. But, you know, you did have more people like, again, your Amanda Bynes as opposed to Kevin Kubitschek, which people don't know today because he's a teacher in Canada. But, you know, he was doing something pretty special and you can't do that on television.
One of the other things Nickelodeon was known for, along with the shows featuring kids, was the animation. You had shows like Doug and Rugrats, and then the weird outlier, Ren and Stimpy. That's a show I watched in my 20s, and I was kind of amazed when I found out it was on a kid's channel. How did this really weird, offbeat, borderline offensive to some people show make it on the kids' channel?
Well, you know, I think it's really important to note that you were watching it in your 20s. And I don't think that it was just because you were some kind of psychopath or something like that, I would imagine. You know, Nickelodeon was intentionally transgenerational at that time. Yes, it was a children's network, but they really were working hard, much like Pixar and when it's doing something right. You know, they don't always do it, but where they're making something that kids can enjoy, kids can watch, but that their parents watching over their shoulders or sitting next to them on the couch can also enjoy. And Nickelodeon was very, very aware that they had, you know, the typical stoner college student watching some of their shows, not just Ren and Stimpy, but some of the others like Pete and Pete and Out of Control, which was an earlier show. So they wanted to make sure that they had something that was unique, something that stood out among the other cartoons that were on, say, ABC, you know, Saturday morning cartoons. So they worked very hard, Jerry Laybourne again, and a woman named Vanessa Coffey, who basically shepherded the early Nicktoons, to go out, and they quite literally went to the garages and basements of these angry, frustrated, now in their 30s, some early 40s animators who were, you know, struggling in the trenches through the 80s, which a lot of people agree were probably the worst time for animation because it was just, you know, toy-driven shows like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and He-Man and whatnot. And they took these guys and they said, okay, what do you want to do? What do you want to make? And they started finding people like Jim Jenkins for Doug and Gabor Shupo and Arlene Klasky for Rugrats and John Cristolucci for Ren and Stimpy, who basically they took out their, you know, wrinkled up, you know, sketches from their private desks and said, okay, we want to do this. Let us do this. And Nickelodeon said, go for it. And they allowed them to do it. It was literally called creator-driven animation, which was something that hadn't been done since the golden age of animation in the 30s and 40s with Tex Avery and Warner Brothers and that kind of thing. So Nickelodeon said, go and do it. And they let them do it. And for good or ill, Ren and Stimpy happened. And after about 6 episodes, they had to can John Cristolucci because he was a little bit too crazy, even though everyone agrees he's brilliant. But no, they allowed that to happen. And just really quick wrap up. The other thing, too, that I think is really important to note is there was nowhere else for it to go at the time. Again, we're talking about narrow casting here. It's just for children. And animation at that time, and even still now, it's just for kids. So there was nowhere else for it to go. There was no MTV and Liquid Television quite yet. And that certainly, you know, there was no place that Ren and Stimpy could really go aside from Nickelodeon. And they kind of had to work on it and meld it and say, okay, let's make it something that is going to be wild and crazy, but also something that the kids will enjoy and be able to understand as well. So that's when Vanessa came in and kind of molded it into something where you could actually care about the characters and care about Ren and Stimpy. And that brought in this brilliant combination of John's crazy artwork and ideas, but also, you know, something that was for kids as well.
Matthew, very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That's Matthew Klickstein. He's the author of Slimed, an oral history of Nickelodeon's Golden Age.